Welcome to another episode of Photo Geek Weekly. This is episode 41, and it is October 12th, 2018. It's kind of a slow news week, so the conversation might meander down a few interesting rabbit holes, and none better to explore said rabbit holes with me today is Brian Weiss. Brian, it's been a while since I've had you on the show. What's new and exciting with you?
Lots of new stuff. Don, thanks for having me back, and are you trying to imply that I squirrel?
Maybe a little bit.
I do. It's okay. Lots of stuff is changing. My career at Henry's is kind of morphed into the assistant manager role now. There's a lot of changes going on within the company, Henry's, that I work for.
And so Henry's, just to state this, is a camera store here in Canada, and they even just opened up one of their stores out west. I was hearing news about that too.
Coast to coast now. Absolutely. Yeah. It's actually awesome working for the company. It's Canadian owned, third, fourth generation, 100-plus-year-old business. It's pretty exciting to work for a company that can stay that and has the morals and ethics that kind of fall in line with my own, which is really great. But yeah, they've had for years the Learning Lab, where they run photo classes in the stores. And all of a sudden, things have changed. The economy has changed, I guess. And they've made some smart changes to be more efficient, I guess. And one of those changes is to do away with the paid learning program, the Learning Lab courses at Henry's, but kind of replace that. Well, not necessarily replace it, but give an added value within the store level of us organizing these separate workshops now. So we do free workshops, probably around two a month, at least in Newmarket. We're really pushing to do that. And it's been a lot of fun. We've done some really cool topics. We've got Star Trails. I was actually going to talk to you a little bit about maybe some advice for running a little Star Trails presentation we're doing, and all kinds of other really cool workshops that each of us who might be better suited at teaching will run. It's not just one person doing all of them type of thing.
Well, I know when I was working at Black's, another camera chain that was bought by Telus and then eventually closed down, it is no more. But during my time there, when anybody would buy a camera, they would get a free one-on-one, one-hour lesson with that camera. And that was a nice value add for the customer. And it helped with customer loyalty and coming back into the store and asking the salespeople at that particular store, which you've now learned to trust a little bit more, what their opinions on certain things are. And so there's a lot of sense made with that. Curious though that they just kind of cut out all of the paid courses. It's not like people aren't taking workshops. Right. I hold a lot of them and they sell out. But I think that might be the issue, is that people are going towards the photographer that they know and love and learning directly from them and not necessarily wanting to pay that same amount of money to just take it at a faceless camera store. I mean, there's a lot of faces at Henry's that I enjoy and I love, but if you have the workshop not branded under one specific photographer that is known, internationally, for example, then you might not get the same response.
Right. And they dabbled in the whole, they brought Lindsay Adler in and they brought in a couple other, as you say, name photographers to run workshops. Peter Hurley, they ran one with and so on, which I believe went very well. My buddy Ross help them with that quite a bit. And Ross does some of our workshops in Newmarket. So the workshops that we're running, as opposed to it being a paid course, like we were just talking about, they're more one specific topic and they can last up to 2 hours and a bit. We've done vlogging, we've done all kinds of different things. So I think they're more related to what people want to learn now, rather than just these workshops that have been around for the past how many years and just kind of, going over the same topics over and again with different people. Now you're bringing in the same people again and again and again to learn something a little bit new and fresh. So it's bringing people into the store, since it's a lot of fun to do. And, it's kind of right up my alley anyway. It's with organizing these workshops and doing things. So it's nice that I can help out Lindsay, our manager, and do that.
Yeah. And, I'm thinking too that, good on Henry's for opening up new stores and growing and changing the way that they approach their customer base to stay relevant, because that's a really hard thing to do in today's economy.
Yeah. YouTube and B&H and, American and China and all these different avenues that people can go and buy their gear. I think it's nice that Henry's is refocusing on their skilled employees and better training and better sales training. And there's a lot of things like that down the pipe. So it's exciting. Cool.
Well, talking about training too, I mean, you have your Day Tripper Photo community, which I was thinking about you recently because there was the announcement this week that Google Plus will be no more as of about 10 months from now. And I know you built your online community on that platform, right?
Well, there's specific reasons for it too. I mean, you can have really properly displayed photos. You can read EXIF information. So if you're giving a photo review, critique, whatever you want to call it, and you want to find out, is this blurry because the shutter was too slow, or is it blurry because it was a small file and it's just been enlarged or whatever? I mean, rather than critique a blurry photo and say, this is crap, or what, we don't say that, but and say, this is, it could be improved in this way or that way. But it's because of the compression or it's because of other things, we can read the EXIF and actually understand what went on to make the photo. And that's something that you can't find in very many places. So
yeah, about the only place where I know will cater to that kind of content would be Flickr.
And that's kind of where I'm looking right now to migrate the community over to Flickr. I'm dabbling. I deleted my Flickr account years ago when we had Ross. I had Ross on my web show that I had run at the time. And the topic was copyright. And Ross basically lambasted Flickr and said that they steal everything that you do. And I read the fine print, and there were some things in there that were questionable. A lot's changed. You know, everybody's trying to make a buck off
SmugMug. So SmugMug, I mean, they've got their whole business model, and Flickr's now under their umbrella. Hopefully that they will revamp and introduce some modernized features to Flickr. I think we've seen a little bit of that. Last I heard, they were basically reworking the entire back end to be compatible with the system that all of their engineers are more familiar with. So on the outward facing side, it might look the same, but all of the internals have been shifted around and made to work properly with them. So they're working on it. And you know, I've loved Flickr for a number of things. The fact that you can view the images at very high resolution without much compression, that the EXIF data is right there. Mm-hmm. They've had commenting on individual photos as well as groups for a very long time, and their group system is kind of broken. And yeah. And I hate when you've got probably not as much anymore, but people would comment like a little award animated GIF when you would post it into certain groups because they had a requirement, and this was all just user run, and it kind of developed its own culture around it. Where if you were to post an image, it was a rule that you would have to comment on two or three other images. And I like that concept because it would keep the engagement up within a particular group. But a lot of people just were sending out like animated GIF awards that cluttered up comment streams, and that was of no help to anybody.
It didn't achieve anything, yeah.
It didn't achieve anything. So you look at what it was and what it might become, and I think that's the most viable platform moving forward. It's really unfortunate, though, because, I mean, I was listed as a suggested user to follow in the early days of Google Plus under the photography category, and that raked in 1.3 million followers on that platform.
Wow.
Which was interesting because I never really saw that level of engagement from that volume of followers compared to, I've got around 14 or 15,000 on Facebook right now, which are always more engaged than even when Google Plus was highly used and I had those numbers. So, you know, people, probably a lot of robots, non-English speaking people, et cetera, that signed up for Google Plus, or maybe just general people that signed up for the platform, clicked on a bunch of follow things when they first registered and then never used it at
all. Right. And that's the thing I think that really hurt Google Plus is the engagement was so low at this point that it was just didn't make it feasible to keep that going. And it's unfortunate, like you were saying, because the walls format within the community, the ability to create different walls within a community. I can have one for a buy and sell. You know, I can have one for just my photo contest. So if I want to just see the photos for the photo contest that we run, I can just go to photo contests and that's all you see. You're not going to see everything. And that's the clutter that you're going to find on Facebook or Flickr or any of these other places. So I'm kind of still keeping my eyes open. I've been on Facebook with Day Tripper since the start. It's just, I never found it as viable really as what we got from the community on Google Plus. And that's unfortunate. And it's going to be a big loss. And I hope that other companies like Flickr and so on see the gap and morph into that role.
Well, and I hope that your community all follows you. I mean, it is a fairly loyal community, and I'm in there, and I kind of poke my head in once in a while. But I people like you are the real people that end up suffering here. And it's a real shame because this is all coming about because of a security vulnerability that Google had identified that could have potentially affected 500,000 users. But it wasn't reported to them by somebody else. It was discovered internally. And they had no evidence that it had ever been exploited by anybody. Now, they don't keep records for security reasons for all of these logs going back to the beginning of time. I think it was only 2 weeks or 2 months, a shorter period. But there was no evidence during that time that anybody had ever exploited this particular vulnerability. So it's a shame that they have to bring this to light now and close down the platform as like sort of a bad press issue.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And nothing happened.
No, nothing happened.
And nothing even happened. Well, it's better to be proactive, though, especially with people's security these days.
I suppose so. Well, let's get into the stories of the week. And so one that I wanted to talk about on previous episodes, but there was so much news at Photokina that it didn't jump right out at me and say, okay, we have to hit this right away. But it's fun to talk about it now. Venus Optics is a Chinese manufacturer, I believe. They're either Chinese or Korean, I can't remember, but somewhere in Asia. They have their Liowa line of lenses for pretty much every size of camera, sensor, and mount. And they've just announced, I found this quite ridiculous, 8 new and often quite unique lenses. They're all purely mechanical lenses for what I can gather. They range from everything from the Micro Four Thirds platform all the way up to the Fuji GFX medium format, which is a really interesting lens to have in this rollout. So, Brian, first of all, what do you think about some of the lenses on this sort of roadmap that will be released in the very near future? And what do you think about a company that, you know, was almost completely unknown a few years ago making headlines like this?
Well, I think it's always good when you have a company come out of nowhere with products that people can get better images from. I mean, how could you go wrong with that? I've not really played with these lenses. I don't have any experience using them, but looking at the specs and looking at what they're meant to do, it's really interesting. I think you, of all people, will enjoy what they're coming out with. I mean, a 12mm f1.8 for your Micro Four Third mount.
That sounds really interesting. But
a
even
24mm 1.8. I mean, the possibilities for shooting lots of things. Like for my world, wrestling, that would be pretty awesome to do portraiture at 1.8 and have a huge vista background and have a wrestler there nice and sharp because the edges are true and it's not stretchy and distorty like a lot of other lenses are. So
exactly.
That could be really neat.
Or even like their 4mm f2.8 fisheye, I don't know if anybody is making a fisheye that wide. Its field of view, I think, was something like 210 degrees, so it sees behind itself.
And you can do your 360-degree stuff with that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was so wide, though, that on one of the sample photographs that I had seen, the camera's grip was in the shot because of just the design of the camera. So, I mean, your mileage may vary with that, but it is still unique. And I love the fact that the second lens in this particular feature, they have a 60mm macro. They now have a 100mm macro that will achieve a 2:1 magnification.
I was thinking of you when I read that. Yeah,
and that is very useful. It's one of the reasons why I've been loving the Micro Four Thirds platform, because 1:1 magnification on a Micro Four Thirds camera is the equivalent of 2:1 on a full frame sensor. And for the longest time, it was pretty impossible outside of novelty lenses, microscope objectives, or the Canon MPE 65mm macro to get beyond 1:1 without adding stuff onto it. And so they've got a number of lenses now that will get you 2:1 magnification. You want to get closer, you can still add extension tubes, but it's built right into the lens.
So does that mean that if it's 2x macro on your cameras, on your Four Thirds stuff, it would be 4x?
Effectively, yeah. Now, I don't know if they've got one designed for Micro Four Thirds, although this one could be adapted. I think this was designed more for a full frame camera. But I've been adapting my regular Canon EF lenses to Micro Four Thirds for quite a long time, and I've been having some great results. Also in this lens lineup, they've got a 9mm f2.8 0D, that's their zero distortion moniker, for the DJI mount. So they are really branching out, and you know, good on DJI for having a lens mount that third parties can manufacture product for.
I know that nobody does that I know of. I didn't even know they did it until I read this.
Yeah. So exciting. Now, of course, all of these lenses are purely mechanical. And so that means that you're going to be controlling the aperture manually. You're going to be controlling focus manually. But if you are a landscape photographer, if you're using some of the really wide angle stuff to do astrophotography, for example, autofocus really doesn't apply to you.
Right.
And I do, with most of my macro stuff, all manual focus anyways. The thing about these lenses, and I don't think that they've announced specific pricing for them, but they are much less expensive than the known brand name counterparts of Canon, Nikon, even Sigma. You know, you might get prices around like a Tokina lens or something similar to that. So it's a less expensive alternative. But this also is a point of contention for me, because you've got all of these Chinese manufacturers, of which I've used products from Liowa, from Yongnuo, who makes some great flashes that are a fraction of the price of Canon or Nikon flashes. And they're really good. The big manufacturers are going to have a hard time coming out with products that compete. But the retailers, from your end of things too, Brian, are going to have a hard time even selling the product, because Canon and Nikon won't let you. And I'm sure there's some deals that says, okay, you know, if you want to carry our flashes, that's great, but you can't carry the Chinese knockoffs at the same time.
Well, I can't speak for purchasing. I don't know right. what the rules
I don't
are.
Want to put words in your mouth there.
But at the same time, we do carry Godox, and I literally just exchanged Mr. Snaps, my D700, for 5 Godox flashes.
Yeah.
A 12-year-old, possibly 12-year-old, 11-year-old, 12-year-old camera for 5 brand new flashes that have built-in radio transmitters and receivers that will work really, really well for my wrestling stuff that I do, where I have flashes off camera. Different channels, they are effective. They work very well. In the store new, they're $160 or something like that. I mean, yeah, we have a lot of these cheap products as well. And it's a double-edged sword. On one hand, you want to save money. On the other hand, you know, the quality isn't the same. It's just not the same. I can't speak for these lenses, but for the flashes themselves, like the top doesn't lock, and yeah, there's cosmetic and fit and finish differences that are frustrating when you've used the original flashes already. But hey, it saves a lot of money, and I was able to really add some versatility to my overall kit.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm all for having choices and options. I wish that they were more universally accessible to walk into a store and buy them. I know B&H stocks most of this stuff. I mean, they are a juggernaut within the North American sales for cameras on both sides of the border. Mm-hmm. And I'll often, even for things like ink for my printer, it just doesn't make sense half the time to buy them in Canada, because it's like a commodity price in the US, and it's like $100 more after exchange and shipping and everything per ink tank, and the printer takes 12 of them.
Yeah.
There are certain things that it's
you have to be spendthrift. You're not going to succeed in business if you're not wise to how to spend money.
Exactly. But that doesn't mean that you have to spend a lot of money on a high-end Zeiss manual focus lens when Liowa might have something that suits your needs. It might not have the same resolving power, but that might not matter to you, because you're just after the shot, and it doesn't have to be printed mural size on the wall. You know, for the most part, a lot of people, you know, they'll post it on social media like we were just talking about to begin with, yeah. And maybe make a smaller print. And most lenses today have the resolving power to get very good results at that.
And I think a big problem that I've noticed, I don't know if it's all of a sudden or if it's always been that way, but gearhead syndrome is becoming rampant. Like, yeah. So many people are flipping and flipping and flipping. Oh, I can't get the A7II. I got to get the A7III. I can't get it. My photos aren't good enough with a D700. I got to buy myself a DA50. I mean, look, I work in retail. I get it. We need that turnaround. We need that turnover. But when it comes to making images, Don, I learned from you a long time ago, use what you got, know how to use it, and do the best you can with what you have. You don't always have to go and buy new stuff. I'm rocking a D7100 right now, and this is what I'm going to use pretty much all the time, with an old 24-85 D lens and my old 50mm D lens. And, you know, maybe I'm not the best photographer in the world, but I'm doing okay, and I enjoy what
image.
I do.
Yeah, a great image, and I know you've made many, Brian, but it's not made by the gear; it's made by the photographer.
Exactly, and to focus on just buying more stuff and having to get the latest and greatest doesn't make sense. Which really kind of makes me like this lineup a little bit more. It's more manual. It's more esoteric. It's, you know, you have some funky lenses that you just can't get a look from in other avenues.
Yeah, you know, I adopted a Pentax 110 lens, which is the size of a quarter, slightly thicker, but I mean, it's the radius of a quarter for a Micro Four Thirds camera. And it's got an image circle big enough to cover the entire sensor. And it just, I mean, I don't think I'd ever really use it aside from maybe, you know, taking it out on a photo walk for conversation sake, but it just looks unusual. And it would spark up a conversation. And could I make a great image with it? Absolutely. But it's not the camera gear that's making the image. It's the photographer. It's the concept that you're exploring. Right. It's the ideas that the camera is simply a tool to express.
And it's also that you know that you're bringing it for conversation. You're bringing it for, you know, hey, look, this can happen too. Look what this little thing can do. And that can inspire other people. And it's not just gear for the sake of gear. It's gear for the sake of continuing education, let's say.
And I will be getting the new Panasonic full frame cameras as soon as they're available, as soon as I can get my hands on one. Will that make me a better photographer? No.
Help your images? Yes.
Well, especially I do occasionally like artwork reproduction photography, and having a camera that is 47 megapixels, then there's an advantage to that in certain cases, rather than doing a grid panorama, which I've had to do for some larger pieces that needed a higher resolution. Definitely, I don't have the right tool for the job, and I would like to have that. And I think that we're never going to be able to avoid this, Brian. Every photographer will see the next generation of product and think, you know what, that's just got more sparkles on it than the one that I have, and that's going to attract me to it, and I'm going to find some justification to make that purchase. That's human nature.
Mm-hmm. And if you've got the money, more power to you.
Exactly. It doesn't mean that you're going to be a better photographer for the purchase, right. You know, with some exceptions.
But I think these lenses can give you that visual difference.
Well, and you look at the 17 millimeter GFX lens, and that's for the Fuji medium format system. Not only is that incredibly wide, wider than 17 would appear on a full frame camera, but it's probably going to be the least expensive lens for that lineup as well, giving photographers, another interesting option to consider, right, rather than just the stuff that Fuji has made thus far.
And yeah. It's considerably less. I mean, the GFX cameras are what, 30,000?
No, the GFX is much less expensive. I think they're they're touting that their new 100 megapixel one would be priced around 10,000 US, and everything else is less than that. Their new 50R, I think, was a $4,500 US price tag. And the current 50 millimeter lens that or body that they have would be priced in between those two. Yeah. But the point is that this is getting less expensive across the board, and that just gives us as photographers more tools at our disposal. End of mm-hmm. story. Check these lenses out in the show notes at photogeekweekly.com, and maybe one of them will kind of tickle your fancy. Keep it on your radar for when it's available.
Very cool.
All right. Speaking of the technology doesn't matter, let's talk about how the technology does matter in some cases. There was a bit of a, I don't want to say scandal, it's a dirty word, but the iPhone XS and the XS Max, people have been testing them and found that there was a quote-unquote beauty mode being applied when the camera detected a face, and it would alter and try to make people more beautiful, smooth out their skin and adjust color tones and what have you. And the internet kind of got angry about this for some strange reason. And I didn't quite understand it myself. So I found an article. This was on Petapixel. This is from Sebastian DeWitt. And he's the designer of the iPhone app Halide. And so he goes into a lot of detail in this article. Brian, did you give this a read?
Yeah, I'm reading it now. I read it last night as well.
Right. So the number of layers that are captured and computed within these images continues to expand, such that the computational photography that Apple is applying here, using various means of additional information from multiple lenses in certain cases, it's just the artificial intelligence algorithms and the deep learning that they continue to evolve and apply over time. It's getting to the point where, yes, your images, they're not going to be made better because you have a better lens and a better sensor. It's going to be better interpreted by the software that's capturing the image. And you can tell this very clearly when you look at a RAW file taken from the iPhone XS, and you notice the noise in that compared to what the camera would create as an output processed file, JPEG or whatever their new format is. Starts with an H. I can't remember the acronym. But this is the evolution of mobile photography. I don't think that this is going away. In fact, I think this is going to be more and more prominent as the technology continues to evolve. What are your thoughts on the computers taking over, at least to some degree, in terms of image quality, and not letting it simply be a version of reality, but enhanced reality, if we could call it that?
Well, technology is always good. Improvements in technology that make imaging better is good. The concept of what's happening here is that you kind of touched on it and didn't really get into what's happening here is that it's taking multiple images and stacking them, very much like your Snowflake stuff, very much like HDR in certain ways, but a different algorithm and a different method of doing it.
And it's not designed to add focus in some cases using the depth controls. It's to decrease focus or to apply sharpening masks or to understand exactly what the color is.
Or to choose the best of the batch or a lot of different things, right? So what they said here is because it does these bursts of photos, it likes to use faster shutter speeds. Mm-hmm. And using faster shutter speeds means you have to then use higher ISO levels to achieve those faster shutter speeds.
And on a sensor that small, cranking up the ISO will create noticeable grain. And then in that case, then you'll have to apply more aggressive noise reduction.
Exactly. And if you're applying, your softening.
Exactly. If you have softer skin, it's because higher ISOs and noise reduction are at play to create that look. But then at the same time, they're applying sharpening algorithms to certain areas too. It becomes very computational, and the end result is a version of reality. It's not the same version that a larger camera would capture, but I don't think that that's a bad thing, to be honest. I mean, I see this trend continuing. I mean, there's no real way to do the product iterations on a yearly cycle like Apple is doing to show meaningful improvements in every part of the platform without going this way.
What I want to see, though, is an improvement in the hardware. I want to see bigger sensors. I want to see better quality lenses. I want to see that kind of stuff. But obviously, size is going to limit everything. So,
yeah.
Every day I get asked by people, like, are cell phones taking over the world? How do you even sell SLR cameras? Well, one word, sensor. You know, a bigger sensor gives you benefits, and a smaller sensor takes some of those benefits away. And whether you want those benefits or you don't, they're there. And if you want the benefit, then you have to buy the bigger sensor. I mean, that's just kind of how it goes.
But here's the problem. We talked about this briefly on the last episode that Panasonic had a Lumix branded smartphone, the CM1, never made it to Canada, but I believe it was in the US market. And they decided not to to go through with a second revision of that, probably because the sales weren't that good. Mm-hmm. If you look up a photo of this camera phone, it had a 1-inch sensor on it. And that means it's going to take very high quality images comparative to a smaller sensor camera of the same generation. But it didn't really feel like a phone anymore. It felt like it was a mobile point and shoot camera, a very, very thin one, mind you, but it didn't have the same aesthetics as a phone. You know, I've got the new Red Hydrogen.
This is what I was just about to get into.
And
yes.
It's got 12 megapixel cameras on the back, and the new iPhone XS is also a 12 megapixel camera. And I haven't done a soup to nuts comparison of the lenses and ISO quality and all of that on it. But for the purposes that I would be using a smartphone camera for, it's family snapshots. It's a behind-the-scenes shot of a setup that I've got in studio to try and illustrate what camera techniques and equipment that I'm using. It's to document things. It's not necessarily to create art. And I know I'm not in the majority of people that are looking at smartphones as a camera. You know, I know a lot of photographers that's all they use, and they want to have it as good as can possibly be. But you can evolve in different ways because, of course, the Hydrogen has two 12 megapixel cameras, not for computational photography in the sense that Apple is using it for, but to generate three-dimensional depth and to then display on its screen in 3D. And you know, I've been using the phone for almost a month now. And the carrier launch in the US, I believe, is November with AT&T and Verizon. And I encourage anybody, when this phone is available, to just stop by your local Verizon store or wherever and just look at it. Because I think that the added depth and the added, literally the added dimension that this has is far more of a revolution than what Apple is doing with their AI technology right now.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Not only that, though, but your phone has the ability, you've got the pins on the back you were showing me earlier, where you can actually attach it to a RED camera in the future.
They'll have modules that will be using actual RED sensors, which would be much larger, much higher quality sensors. And they haven't said exactly what the modules are going to be. There was some speculation based on comments that Jim Gennard, the founder of RED, had made about there being a 2D and 3D cinema quality module and possibly a battery module that would have pass-through pins so that you could, you know, build this monstrosity. And now, at that point, it's no longer a phone. It's a media device.
Right.
So you would have your phone in your pocket, and then you would take the camera component out of a camera bag and add that in, which I don't know if I would actually need, to be honest, based on the way that I shoot. But I will be eyeing that tech, and to see if it comes in at a decent price point, then I might jump on board and experiment with some RED cameras. But
I think that's the technology there that will possibly kill a standard classic DSLR.
Potentially. You know, it's still early days, and the company that makes the screen, Leia, Star Wars reference there, for the holographic display, they call it holographic. It's more of a multi-view 3D kind of effect. They, I'm sure, would license this technology to any company that wants to use it, right? So if Apple or Samsung comes knocking and says, hey, you know what, you know, we see what RED's doing here, we want to put this tech in our next phone, because it doesn't degrade the 2D performance of the device at all. It just gives you the extra mode. And as soon as you've got, you know, sort of a ubiquitous, like, okay, all the high-end phones have this technology, it's a checkbox people have to check off when, you know, coming up with design specs, then we're going to see a huge shift in the market. Will that happen? Well, it didn't happen with 3D TVs because they couldn't get to the glassless tech fast enough. Nope. 3D technology has been around for well over 150 years. I have an antique stereoscope that was built in 1867. 3D has an impact. And when people look through that stuff, they swear with delight. I love it when people, like, and they cover their mouths. It's like, oops, sorry, I didn't mean to, but I really enjoyed, you know, it jumped right out at me. If I can get people to see that effect just by pulling my phone out of my pocket and showing them some of my work, that's where the magic happens. So I'm more interested in that tech than what Apple is doing here. I know I'm in the minority, but it's the minority. It's the geeks that are listening to this podcast.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. I mean, you're talking to a person here who they can see through make marketing, and they can see through, you know, a fad technology that is just a transitionary technology. It's not an end game technology. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
End game technology is something that will really revolutionize things. This is transitionary. This is like, okay, we've got this cool thing that nobody else is doing right now, and your pictures are going to look okay. But if you compare them to other things, you might find this isn't quite this or that. You know what I mean? Like, they're not at that point yet. So.
Yeah, well, and I'm excited to see RED has been known to put their muscle behind things with everything that they've got. And this phone is a direct indicator of that. But what about the next version and the next version? Uh-huh. You know, this tech is only going to get better and better over time. And it will be a delight to see how far this evolves. So anyhow, let's get back on track here for the stories. Cool. I found this this fun little read on Petapixel, how to make a $10 DIY disco light modifier for round head flashlights. And so it is exactly what you think it might be. They make LED lights that have these kind of disco effect. It's like a molded piece of glass into a complex, like, octahedral prism type shape. I'm not sure exactly how many facets it has, but if you just unscrew that piece of plastic from the LED light, you can plug that into or cover the output of a flash. Now, they're using a circular flash here, the Pro Photo, I think the new one that they just announced. But I'm sure this would work just fine over any flash or even a sufficiently bright flashlight too.
All you need is your favorite little Pringles container and mold the one side over your flash and stick the round side on the other side. That would,
you know what?
There you go.
The fact that we both have Pringles cans within reach, you know, we're not recording video here, but there's the proof. There's a lot of ways to inexpensively modify light. And that's why I wanted to bring this up. Not only did I, as soon as I read this article, went out and spent the $10, a little bit more here in Canada to get one of these things. But the effect that it creates for very interesting soft light onto a wall, I could find potentially useful for a lot of my macro photography output. I immediately thought, how cool would this be as like a secondary light to illuminate the landscape around a freezing soap bubble outside, right? And possibly play around with some colored filters to get some slight variations on the color, not just all one static color. Which I could easily do with some colored cellophane and gluing that to the inside of this little dome. There's a lot of creative potential as soon as you start to get inventive with photography. And I love using things that are not intended for photographic purposes to create the exact look and desire that you would want. So, Brian, I doubt Henry's is going to be stocking these disco lights anytime soon. It's not something that you're going to get into a camera store specifically. But what kind of things have you come across in your experience that have been like that Pringles can idea, which is a wonderful light modifier that you think people might be able to use creatively?
Well, I'm just hearing you talk and I have all these things that I've been playing with and, you know, photos that I have examples of and things like that going through my head. The example you gave of firing this against a wall, have you ever heard of the light blaster?
Light blaster? I mean, not specifically, but...
So it's a rig that you put on the front of your flash and you can get these little gel inserts, like aperture inserts kind of thing. And mm-hmm. you stick them into the rig. And when the flash fires, it puts a pattern onto the wall. So I've used this light blaster. They let me borrow it a while back. And it was a lot of fun because I do a lot of light painting and I'm doing a little section. And then I fire this pattern like a racetrack in the background and it gives a completely different dimension. So I kind of wanted one of those, but what I was going to talk about is something a little different. I know that we're not doing the video for the purpose of your podcast, but I'm showing a one of those little $10 little fiber optic brushes.
Like novelty lamp things,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's got that triangular base in the bottom that has LED lights that light up and the thing kind of blows in the wind and the little fiber optic pieces kind of glow. Well, they are super cheap if you buy them online, like $2 to $5. And if you pull out the fiber optic plug part and you kind of throw away the triangle thing, you don't need it. And then you go over to Canadian Tire and you buy a little $5 little wand, a light flashing wand. You press the button on the back and it changes colors, blue, red, green, whatever. Put a little shield on that so that the light doesn't shine through. Attach your fiber optic to it and you've got a little fiber optic brush that's lighted in any color you want it to be. That you can use for light painting. You can drag it. You can shake it and give it a ghosty
look. Yeah, light painting
look
would be the perfect thing for that, right?
Oh, my favorite thing on earth is light painting, aside from shooting wrestling. Now, I've got the really properly machined versions of these from light painting brushes. I talked about them the last time that I was on your show. But to pay your whatever you want to pay for this, it's like $35, $40 or something for that. Meanwhile, $15, you can go and buy $5 this and the $10 that, which probably even get it cheaper than $10.
Or maybe you already have an LED flashlight. I've got one that has a red, green, and blue lighting mode. Nightcore mm-hmm. makes a bunch of these in addition to the really bright white LEDs. Built right into that with a bit of gaffer's tape. I mean, yep. you're laughing.
Gaffer's tape is my best friend. I use it for everything. I'm using it to hold my headphones together right now. I mean, literally, I love gaffing tape. And it's all over these wands. You can use it to hold the shield in place. You can use it to have like a little piece where it'll hold the fiber optic to the unit so it doesn't fall off. I mean, yeah, it never ends. And MacGyvering your stuff together is what light painting's all about. And it's just so fun. And I just encourage everybody to try it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got nothing to lose except a couple of dollars and some time to experiment with. But I mean, I remember writing an article for Outdoor Photography Canada magazine, and I did two of them because the first one was such a success, about free or cheap things to add to your camera bag. And some of them were really novel that you might not have expected. Like if you don't want to spend good money on a good neutral density filter. You can go and buy yourself a $7 piece of welding glass, which is horribly green tinted, and you can correct for that somewhat in post. But you know, if you're shooting black and white, that doesn't really matter. You would just get a very, very dark, around 10 stops or so, neutral density filter that you would just. I used gaffer's tape to hold it on the front of my lens. And it worked wonders. I do have, yes, a more expensive neutral density filter, but it's still fun to experiment and say, how cheaply can I accomplish this particular goal, right?
That sounds like a challenge.
Yeah,
exactly. You should issue a cheap goal challenge.
Yeah, well, I mean, like I we had talked about it four or five episodes ago about buying a Zenith 50 millimeter F2 Soviet era lens and adapting it, of course, to a modern camera mount, but taking it apart and putting one of the internal lens elements back in backwards. And it creates this weird abstract bokeh effect that, yes, it's quite distortive of reality, but if you're looking to create abstract work, those lenses are $35. Yeah. And if you mess it up, well, that was kind of your goal to begin with.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love things like that. You got to have fun with photography. I mean, you get to a certain point, and if you're, especially if you're a commercial professional photographer where you rely on certain things to keep your income going, it gets tedious over time. So to think outside the box and to do something funky, it's always good.
Yeah, well, and it's kind of fun when I would look back through old photography books to try and find some inspiration, and especially in the film era. Photographers tended to be much more inventive than I find them to be today. And there was one book on darkroom techniques. And I've never actually, I've developed film, but not in a darkroom. I've never done darkroom printing. So it was interesting to read through the book. There was one page that had a photo of a ship, and it was like a smaller boat, in a harbor with a bunch of other ships. And the photographer's goal was to make the center one clear, but to blur all of the other ones. And the method to do that was to take a piece of acetate, that's the clear overhead projector material, and cut a hole in it. And then while the image was being exposed, just move that sheet around so that the edges became softer. Wherever the sheet was present was distorting the light and blurring things. Where the hole was clear. And as you were moving it around, you're kind of feathering that edge.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it struck me as just brilliantly simple, but inventive. And if we're not inventive as photographers, then we're doing it wrong. Our work's not going to stand out.
So true. It kind of makes me think of the next thing I think you were going to talk about, the Hasselblad Instax.
Yeah, well, let's just dive right into that, because again, this was another fun DIY hack where this was from, forget the name of the photographers here, designer Isaac Blankensmith. Given new meaning to the concept of a hybrid camera. I'm reading here from F-Stoppers. By harvesting the front of a Hasselblad 500C/M and the rear of a Fujifilm Instax Mini 9, and has Frankensteined these two cameras together, which I think is a thing of beauty. The Hasselblad 500 cameras, by the way, they can be found online on eBay for much less expensive than a modern medium format digital camera. You might even be able to find some at yard sales. I picked up one for $100 a couple of years ago.
Nice.
And I was very happy with that purchase. But, you know, I have a love and hate relationship with film because I love the novelty of shooting on analog medium. I love the tactile response of mechanical parts. And these cameras were heavy and metal and they're fun to use. And then I just have a drawer full of exposed film that I never bother to develop or scan. So if I were to be able to shoot on instant film like this with an Instax Hasselblad hybrid and get that immediate gratification that I am so used to, almost addicted to in the digital world, sign me up. What do you think, Brian?
I think it's so cool. It looks cool. And I just think it's funny that they call it like a Hasselstax or a Franken camera. I love it. You can't see, obviously, in the podcast, but here you have Carl Zeiss lens on a Hasselblad with this plastic white Instax thing jammed where the back would be.
I love how they kept the flash intact and everything.
Yeah. It's awesome. It's just ingenuity. And I think for somebody to just go around with something like this at a photo walk or something, the conversations, like you were saying earlier, the conversations would just be insane.
It would be a lot of fun. I mean, yeah, I've been known to take medium format 3D cameras on photo walks and even a 4x5 camera. That was quite the conversation piece there as well. But imagine just like, even if I'm traveling and I want to take a quick snap and give that as an immediate gift, like a leave behind for something, this would be the camera to do it. And a lot of people have used the Instax cameras, the Polaroid cameras for years for exactly that purpose. Mm-hmm. But what if I can get it much higher quality? Here we have something that I want. I almost want to email these guys and say, do a Kickstarter campaign, please. Yeah. I don't care what you have to do. Take my money.
I wonder how Fuji and Hasselblad would feel about that.
Well, Hasselblad really wouldn't necessarily care because the backs for their cameras were always sort of removable, and you can put a digital back on an older mm-hmm. camera body. That technology has existed forever. Fuji, well, I don't know if they'd have any issue with somebody not
as
necessarily
long as
taking
the camera.
Or maybe they're making their own, but it's going to take the Fuji film, and Fuji's going to make money on the film. So
I did a brown box challenge a while back, one of my YouTube videos, the brown box challenge from Fuji. They gave me all the product inside. In there was one of their little Instax printers. Mm-hmm. And another one was an Instax camera and a bunch of little tchotchkes and accessories. It was fun. We walked around Main Street with these little Instax cameras, and we were able to use our cell phone, take a picture, send it to the Instax digital printer right there in the middle of, you know, Ferry Lake and Newmarket. And we're giving these people their prints of their little dog or whatever we took a picture of with it. And people were having so much fun. You know, it was just like you were saying, it's such a conversation piece. It's such a fun thing to talk about and say, here, take this with you. And here, ladies, this is for you, you know, enjoy. And it's a keepsake of a fun moment.
Exactly. Photography as a profession for both of us in different avenues. It's how we pay the bills. Right. And so sometimes working for a paycheck can sometimes take the fun out of it. Mm-hmm. And I'm always looking for ways to bring that fun element back in. And this is screaming to me, FUN. Even like to get one of these Instax cameras. And it is a much bigger modification than I did for these old Zenith lenses of taking them apart. So I think it might be a bit beyond me. I want to take a look at the entire process and maybe give it a shot, because the cost of a Mini 9 might just be worth the cost of the experiment.
Yeah, they're $90, I think.
Yeah.
They're not bad. It's funny that you say fun. You have to have fun. You have to make time for fun. I do something called an I shoot for me day. Everything I do, if I'm just having fun for myself, hashtag I shoot for me, because that's what you have to do. I mean, you're working, you're teaching, you're shooting, you're printing, you're doing all the things you do day in and day out for you. For me, it's, you know, working at Henry's, it's doing day trips, it's trying to market, it's trying to do the business side, it's trying to build a community and all the other things. Sometimes you just have to say, you know what? October 17th is the day that weed is legal in Toronto or in Canada. And I'm going to go down to Toronto and do some street shooting, because who knows what you're going to see, right? It could be the coolest street photography day ever.
If there was any day to do street photography, October 17th is probably the best one.
So that's my I shoot for me day. Whoever wants to come, you're welcome. It's going to be fun. We're going to go down to Toronto and do some crazy stuff.
Brian, before you carry on from that, you know, where can people find you and your workshops? I know we usually do that at the end, but it's the perfect segue right here.
Daytripperphoto.com. That's me. If you find me on Facebook, that's where I'll put some stuff out. I usually put it out through the Daytripper Photo community on Google+, because it's private and I can share something like this and I will get people I know who will say, yeah, sure, let's take the subway down or whatever, right? So the community, I'm going to miss that. But you say we have about 10 months left?
August is where they're going to be finally closing things down.
Good. That's plenty of time. So there, you can find me there. You can find me on YouTube, Daytripper Photo on YouTube, Brian Weiss. Search around. It's Brian with a Y in, by the way. So if anybody's looking for me and you look for Brian with an I, you'll find a psychologist,
cool.
Which I am not.
I guess we're at about the point now where we're going to go into the picks of the week, unless you had any further comments on fun shooting.
No, that's good. That's good.
Okay. So my pick of the week is something that is decidedly unfun. Because I, you know, It's painful when I discover that my images have been infringed upon. Although, if it's a commercial infringement, I take legal action. I've got attorneys that I work with in Canada, the US, and internationally. And I will send them any viable cases, and some of them get, you know, taken on contingency. Most of them do, which is great. And that'll allow me to you know, afford the lawyer to go after any of these cases. But how do you find your images that are being infringed? And a lot of photographers have their work being stolen and they don't even realize it. So I was actually put onto to this website by my U.S. attorney, Leslie Burns. She's at burnstheattorney.com. Great lady. She discovered a website called infringement.report. That's the URL, infringement.report. So report is the TLD there. And they have a system where you can trial it out for three images and just see what comes up. But I pay $25 a month and it will allow me to search 300 of my images that it does a daily scrape of the internet to find every place where those images show up. Now, I've done some research in other platforms, and I've used Google Images. Bing.com has an image reverse image search algorithm as well. There's TinEye. There is Yandex, the Russian search engine. Now, all of these do it well, but Infringement Report kind of covers all of the bases. I'm not sure exactly what they're doing algorithm-wise, but it can let you search based on folders and image lists, they call it, if you're looking for specific things. Or you can sort the websites based on country of origin, based on the language that the websites are in, because I get so many infringements in Chinese or Russian or some other Cyrillic language, or there's whatever language has a million umlauts on it, like, you know, Vietnamese, that is like, okay, well, I doubt I'll be able to enforce my copyright in Vietnam. So let's move that and Nepal and Pakistan away and focus more on the ones that I would likely be able to recover something from. So infringement.report is the website that allows me to very neat and tidily, find all of the infringements. But what I like about the service is they have no interest in actually pursuing them. So I am free to contact my own attorneys to pursue that on my behalf. Now, this is in contrast to Image Rights International, which I also use for some of my international cases. I find them and I send them to them if I have an infringer in, I don't know, Germany or Italy, or Turkey, or they've got lawyers in many different places around the world. But if I was using them as a search vector, in their terms of service, they have the right of first refusal for anything that they find. So if I have a good case that I want to send to an attorney that I already have a good working relationship with, but Image Rights found it, I can't legally send that to my lawyer without them first either making an attempt at it or refusing to take the case. Mm. And so that's been bothersome for me. That's why I've stopped using them as a searching system. But I still employ their legal team when required for some of the tricky international cases. So infringement.report, that is my pick of the week. And I encourage, you know, if you haven't looked for your work, even if you don't want to pay $25 a month, just do a quick Google search for some of your most popular images. Or if you subscribe to this this service, solving or settling one case a year would more than pay for it. So It's definitely worth our while as photographers to start defending our work a little bit more readily.
Cool. So what you're saying is if I want to tell everybody that your macro B photo is actually mine, I should just move to Nepal and post from there.
Yep. Absolutely.
Okay. Good to know. Sorry.
No, well, you know, it is tricky because sometimes if people are posting my work on social media, sometimes they claim it to be theirs, and that's a big no-no. And if it's on Facebook or anywhere else, I will send them a takedown notice. And most large companies, if they receive a takedown notice, will respond within 48 hours. I think they're legally mandated to do that. So, but I... My images have ended up on products. They've been used in branding. They have gone all over the place. Some companies even used it as their logo. And it's unbelievably frustrating when I come across that. I do get a payday at the end of the day, but, you know, I wish you guys would have just contacted me and we could have talked this out and shaken hands with a smile rather than me making enemies in the world, even though I'm the one that was wronged.
Well, and that's sometimes the side effect, isn't it? You're just trying to protect yourself. And then all of a sudden, well, I don't know if anybody's going around saying, oh, Don Komarechka makes me not want to steal his photos. That's kind of weird, but I know what you're saying. And you don't want to create bad karma, if anything else, right?
Exactly. Well, Brian, I know your pick of the week was kind of the one that you wrapped into our story on the DIY stuff with using a flashlight or a light rod with the little fiber optic thing. So I just wanted to mention that again. But if you were lusting after any new piece of camera gear, let's just kind of change the conversation here. What would that be? Because you are going to buy new camera gear at some point in the future.
Oh, yeah.
Every photographer is. So what's on your radar?
At this point, it's a new body. I need a new body. And I've been considering a 750 for a long, long time, Nikon D750. But, you know, now that I've traded in Mr. Snaps and I'm just rolling with a D7100, I think I'm just going to wait. I'm going to check out the mirrorless world. I'm going to see what comes out next. I mean, Panasonic has full frame now, and I've always been a Panasonic fanboy. I love their gear. So I love the ease of use, their functionality, their ergonomics. I just think they make sense. So once I get my hands on a Nikon Z6, which is kind of where I'm focusing, and then if I ever get my hands on the Panasonic and check out the Canon EOS R and check out all these new full frame mirrorless, that may be what I do next.
Right. And, you know, you can keep your existing lenses. I don't know who's making them now. I think NovoFlex has one for the Leica. It was designed for the Leica SL, now the L mount. I'm sure third-party manufacturers are going to come along. Sigma's announced an EF lens to L mount adapter. No idea if they're going to do an Nikon F mount, but somebody will. And you'll be able to use any existing lenses that you have if you wanted to keep them and do your investment into the new system kind of periodically.
I think for what I would end up getting for my 7100, I would end up just keeping it and using the lenses I have on it and just focus on the new compatible glass and so on. But that's all in due time.
Right. Well, and we've talked about this before, but any of the new lenses designed for the new mirrorless cameras will be decidedly better than the same kind of lens designed for a flapping mirror type camera.
Right.
Just by the flange distance and the size of the rear element and all that, your existing lenses will perform as well as they did on your current camera. But new lenses designed for the new system will exceed the previous performance levels. So it's always food for thought. The ball is always rolling farther, and as photographers, we never seem to be able to catch it because it never stops.
True, but I'm lucky that I'm in a position that I'm not in a rush to buy a new camera. I don't have to force a decision. A lot of people are like, oh, I want the A7 III because it's new, and by the time it's available for me to buy, the A7 IV will be announced.
Keep a camera body for 3 or 4 years, maybe longer than that, until the technology comes along that says, okay, you have more creative potential.
This will improve your world.
It's more viable for your business opportunities that you need to make this purchase because it's an investment and it has to pay off. If it's an investment that's just a marginal upgrade over the one that you currently have, but it's costing you a lot of money, maybe it's not a good investment.
Exactly. And that's where I've been for the past 10 years, just rolling with what I've got and making it work. And luckily I can borrow a thing or two once in a while.
So. You have perks of the job, I'm sure.
I'll tell you about it.
Yeah, you get to experiment with all the cameras, even just in-store, to pick them up and get a feel for everything and see how it all works together. And I am envious of that. Although I'm
when
sure
they
if,
arrive.
If I were to walk into your store and want to pick up a camera and play with it, I'm sure I could. Although I'd probably annoy the staff after a little while because I'm not going to be buying them.
Dude, we'd put it in your hand and let you take a walk. It's all good.
There you go. All right, Brian, this ends another episode of Photo Geek Weekly. We can find you and all of your musings and workshops at daytripperphoto.com, and all of your links to social media are there. And if anybody wants to find the links of the stuff that we talked about, the links to where you can find Brian, that is all at photogeekweekly.com. Thanks to everybody who has listened this far to the very end of the episode and hasn't cut out by now. You're the best, and thank you for your support. Thanks for listening. Keep spreading the word. I know a few people recently wrote some reviews on iTunes, and that is so greatly appreciated. And I think that our listenership numbers have gone up as a result. So if you do enjoy the show, please give me 5 minutes of your time after you're done listening to this. Log into iTunes, find Photo Geek Weekly and leave us a quick little blurb about how you enjoy, because that helps with discoverability. More people listening means it's more of a priority for me to do these every week. So thanks to everyone listening, and it's time to get out and shoot.